This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Last week, Academy Award-winning actor Regina King lost her only child to death by suicide. King's son, Ian Alexander Jr., was just 26 years old and was a rising musician and DJ. Since learning of Ian's death, I haven't been able to stop thinking of Regina King and of the very particular agony of losing someone we love dearly to suicide. It's how I lost one of my close friends and colleagues back in 2017. And, you know, I still haven't deleted his number from my phone. Sometimes when something like outrageous happens, something that I know he would get, something that we would have laughed about and honestly we would have been kind of snarky about, I'll start to text him. And then I remember he's gone. And I'm sad and I'm angry and I'm confused. And in that moment, I really just want my friend. As a kid, I didn't know why my mother would tear up at the opening credits of our family's favorite TV show, MASH. But it always happened with the first notes of Johnny Mandel's theme song. Only later did I learn that her first husband, my sister's dad, who was a Vietnam veteran, had died by suicide. His life was lost before mine even began, but the echoes of grief shaped my mom, and by extension, me. So we know that suicide touches many of us and our families, and we asked you about it. And here's some of what you shared.
Hi, this is Sarandon calling from Brooklyn. The question regarding suicide of a young person struck me hard today. It is the 17th anniversary of my sister's suicide just before she was 16. And even though the pain does dissipate every year, it's still a heavy burden that me and my siblings and my parents have to carry every year, particularly on this day. It also drove me to a life of serving those in the mental health field. I've been a therapist now for almost 15 years, so it does not go away, but it does help you appreciate the time that you have and want people to be as happy and as healthy as possible.
My name is Lee, and I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York. And my family has been affected by the suicide of a young person, unfortunately, my cousin's 15-year-old daughter. And, you know, we really had to consider, like, what the mental health supports were that our entire family needed. The young people, the older people, we had no idea that something was going on that could have led her to suicide. And at this point, we still haven't found out exactly what may have been triggers or the catalyst for her that led her to this end point. So as a family right now, we're really rallying to support everyone in our family.
Hello, my name is Deborah, and I'm calling from Bellevue, Washington. About a year ago, we lost a 19-year-old in our family, and this was on top of my mother having lost her husband of 40 years to COVID. It's been a particularly challenging year for the parents of my nephew. And he was a wonderful, bright 19-year-old who apparently didn't thrive during online learning and going to college. But time has healed all wounds that can be healed. And I know for myself, I have been extra mindful of being there for my daughter, who is 22 and has had depression this year. But thankfully, she came and talked to us, and we were able to support her. My best and warmest heart goes out to all those who have had to deal with some variation of this year.
Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. And although overall suicide rates have decreased in the country in 2019 and 2020, suicide rates for Black, Asian American, and Latino young people are trending upward. Suicide rates have historically been higher among white individuals across all age groups, but research shows that in the past 20 years, suicide rates among Black children younger than 13 years old is 2 times higher as compared with white children. Joining me now is Dr. Michael Lindsay, Executive Director of NYU McSilver Institute for Poverty Policy and Research. Dr. Lindsay, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Melissa, for having me, and I really appreciate being a part of this important conversation.
Important, but difficult. And I guess part of our team, what we really wanted to do in this moment was to try to understand some of this, to understand and contextualize it. Can you talk us through some of the trends? Sort of how has the rate of suicide in the U.S. changed, and maybe particularly for communities of color?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a couple of years ago, in 2019, I, along with colleagues, published a study that appeared in the journal Pediatrics. And what we did was looked at data from 1991 through, at that time, the latest year for which data were available were 2017. And we found that among high school age youth in the United States, that Black youth saw a 73% increase in terms of suicide attempts, whereas other racial and ethnic groups saw a decrease in suicide attempts. I then further looked at the most recent year for which data were available, and that was 2019. So looking at 1991 through 2019, and there was 144% increase for Black youth, while every other racial and ethnic group saw no significant increase in terms of suicide attempts. When you look at suicide behavior, we recently published a study that was featured in two separate articles in the New York Times, where we found that for Black youth, the rate of increase of suicides have been happening increasingly over the span of 2003 through 2017. Again, these are the latest years for which data were available. And what was even further disturbing, Melissa, is that we perceive that suicide is a white phenomena, certainly a male phenomena, but we actually discovered in our study that among adolescents, that Black girls saw a large increase in terms of their annual percentage increase in suicide, which was larger than Black boys. So there is cause to be concerned even for what's happening with young Black girls.
Just a quick note to our audience. We are talking about suicide and self-harm among young people. And so I wanted to remind everyone listening that if you're having suicidal thoughts or you know someone who may be, please call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. Or you can just text HOME to the crisis text line at 741-741. So, Dr. Lindsay, let me come to this on this gendered piece that you just gave us, and on the years. I mean, we're talking here, you're saying in analyzing these data, these are data that lag a little bit the year in which we're living. So these aren't sort of COVID related. This isn't about being pivoted back out to households and having to learn online and not having your social community. This sounds like some kind of grief or anxiety or violence towards the self that is more endemic, more baked in.
Yes, and that's a great point, because you know, before COVID, as you indicated, we were seeing these rates of increase, and I contribute those increases to three factors. And I want to make a really important point in that research has not been reflective of sort of looking at these trends prospectively, right, in terms of the things that might be impacting kids, young adults in the moment. And so what I mean by that is we need to follow kids over time to really understand the ebbs and flows in their lives, what impacts them emotionally, psychologically, et cetera, to really be definitive. But what's plausible, what I think could be happening, and this is based on research that we've done, is that one, Black folks are typically disconnected from treatment when they need to be in those services, right? So stigma plays a big role in terms of mental illness stigma as well as service stigma, right? We don't want to go to a mental health professional because, you know, we think that that's something white folks do, or we might be teased or shunned in our community for doing so. I think you have to look at, over the span of the years that is reflective in our data analyses, there's been an increase in Blacks being killed by law enforcement or vigilantes. There was a study by Jacob Bohr from Harvard in 2018 that showed if you're a Black and you live in the community or in the vicinity of a police killing of a Black person, you're likely to report more days of psychological distress versus if you're white and you live in a proximity to a police killing of a Black person, you don't report those days of distress. So there's a vicarious experience of trauma related to, you know, that situation. And then thirdly, what we've known for a very long time is that kids, Black and brown kids, are disproportionately suspended or expelled from school. This can start as early as preschool. And by suspending and expelling those kids from school, they're not connected to behavioral health supports and services. And they're penalized for having behavioral health problems that warrant behavioral health attention. And so by not addressing those problems early on, they're allowed to fester and become problematic, obviously leading to the point of self-harm behavior. But back to the point of where we are with respect to COVID and the pandemic, and the data has shown this just a little bit, but we need more, that the rate of suicide and engagement in suicide behaviors has continued to increase for Blacks during the pandemic. And when we get through this, I think we're going to see that it has had an incredibly caustic effect on the mental health, psychological well-being of Blacks that might lead to even higher rates, right? These rates don't seem to be trending in a downward trajectory at all.
Michael, as you were talking about the rise in rates among girls and also for Black children, and we know particularly for Black girls, this rate of school pushout being among the highest for any race, gender category. And, you know, my college advisor and mentor was Dr. Maya Angelou. And for everyone familiar with her book, I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings, she was the survivor of a brutal childhood sexual assault and became mute, self-mute, chose not to speak for years. And, you know, that book is very much in those early chapters about her teacher seeing that, noticing that trauma and drawing her in, right? Pulling her in, bringing her to literacy, to books, and helping her find her voice. And when I think about what Dr. Monique Morris has taught us about school pushout, we see trauma-related behavior and we push the kids out, we suspend them. I just keep thinking, what if Dr. Angelou had been suspended and pushed out? Given that trauma, we very well might have lost her to suicide or to any other set of harms. How do we get our institutions to draw our young people in instead of pushing them out?
It strikes me that an incredible policy imperative in our society would be that every school should have mental health providers for kids, and it should be proportionate to the number of kids in school. So we just can't have, Melissa, one professional in the school. But if you have a school of 2,000 kids, that the behavioral health professional should be reflective of the number of kids in the school. So that's first and foremost, because what we know, and again, we've done these analyses, we've mined the data, we know this to be a fact, that when kids have access to a behavioral health professional in the school, they're likely, especially Black kids, they're likely to go to that professional versus being referred to a community-based provider. Also, when that professional is in the school, it can help to socialize the environment to have an appreciation for providing an opportunity for a kid to talk to a professional in lieu of suspending or expelling them from school, right? And so I think in so many ways, it's so important for that professional to be in the schools. And it's part of what we were fighting for in our legislative work, working with the Congressional Black Caucus, developing the report, Ring the Alarm, the Crisis of Black Youth Suicide, and then that report being the basis of federal legislation, the Pursuing Equity in Mental Health Act. That was one of the key points in that bill, that we put more resources into providing that behavioral health support in school for kids. I also think that the way that we look and observe behavior, the way we interpret it, there's all kinds of implicit biases and the frame that we put on the behavior of Black and brown kids that lead them to be suspended or expelled from school, to be deemed a behavioral problem. And so there needs to be a lot of training with teachers and other school personnel on these kinds of implicit biases that tend to have them perceive Black and brown kids in different ways that leads to their suspensions and expulsions. So I think those are two critical issues with respect to that.
I want to ask about one more issue, and I want to ask it carefully because we know that how we have these conversations publicly can actually have an effect on community experiences of suicidality and attempts. I guess part of what I want to understand is when we start talking about completed acts, how much of that has to do with available deadly means and most specifically firearms. I guess I'm wondering if the uptick is in part related to guns being available, that suicidal ideation, even an attempt, may have a very different outcome if there isn't a firearm.
Yeah, you know, one sort of subtle implication from the study we did that found that Black girls are trending upward in terms of completed suicides could be that they are increasingly engaging in more lethal means by which to attempt, and obviously in this case, complete suicide. And so I think that it bears to really monitor restricting the means by which folks have access to the kinds of weapons or means by which to die by suicide. Even in some of the work that we looked at with respect to attempting suicide, we found that there was a trend upward for youth in terms of Black youth, in terms of using increasingly more lethal means. And so I think that's a really, really important policy perspective in all of this, is how do we ensure that kids don't have access to the means by which to attempt suicide and unfortunately die related to the suicide attempt.
Dr. Michael Lindsay is Executive Director of NYU McSilver Institute for Poverty Policy and Research. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you again for having me participate in such an important conversation.
Hi, my name is Maria from Daytona. We lost my cousin when we were very young adults and he had young children. And it's not been the same for my family, almost as if you're not supposed to speak ill of the dead, but we don't speak of him at all. And I feel like I'm the only one who ever mentions him or brings him up and says, oh, you know, you would have loved this, or what do you think about this memory? And so it's become kind of like this wound that's never healed for us, and I don't know how to heal it. And I especially don't know if it ever comes up when it's children or older, which it will, how we talk about it as a family. I don't know, and I wish there was more for those of us left behind.
Yeah, this is Scott from Martinez, California. I met a woman from Nova Scotia on Facebook a couple years back, and we started a relationship and probably going to move there next year. One night last year, she texted me, told me that her beautiful, talented 14-year-old daughter, who left a note saying that she just felt like her life meant nothing and that she was worthless. And I got a text a few minutes later saying that she was gone. And the first year anniversary of that is coming up on February 6th. And it's obviously something that impacts my friend's life every day and impacts my life every day because my daughter has cut herself, and I worry about her all the time.
My name is Natalie, calling from Portland, Oregon, and our family was deeply affected by the suicide of my son 2 weeks before his 21st birthday. He'd been experiencing many personal demons for a few years, so a lot of guilt and blame was spread amongst the family, almost like a meteor crashing into our world, and now we no longer speak. I'm not sure if I will ever be able to recover from my son's suicide in such a way that I can engage with my family again authentically, but I have found some peace within myself, and I think of him every day, and I hope that he has found peace from his demons wherever he is.
And one last time, the number for the National Suicide Prevention Hotline is 1-800-273-8255. Or you can text the word HOME to the crisis text line at 741-741. Take care of yourselves and each other, y'all. It's The Takeaway.
These situations, without a more concerted effort from the international community, will make that virtually every man, woman, and child in Afghanistan could face acute poverty.
You're listening to an urgent plea from the United Nations Secretary General about the serious and swiftly deteriorating situation in Afghanistan. In August, the last U.S. soldier to leave Afghanistan boarded a cargo plane in Kabul and abandoned a country as our nation departed from a place we'd occupied for two decades, leaving behind the Taliban to rule. 5 months later, the United Nations estimates approximately 22 million people in Afghanistan are experiencing starvation as they desperately wait for humanitarian aid. That's more than half the Afghan population. And the choices they face are not familiar to us as Americans. These are not choices between keeping the lights on or buying food. These are far more horrifying.
Babies being sold to feed their siblings. Freezing health facilities overflowing with malnourished children. People burning their possessions to keep warm.
A core reason for this suffering is the U.S. policy of sanctions against the Taliban, which abruptly eliminated the primary support of the Afghan economy.
We are in a race against time to help the Afghan people.
Ali Latifi is a freelance reporter who's joining us from Istanbul. Ali, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
What are conditions like right now in Afghanistan?
The condition right now is that because the economy is essentially at a standstill at this point, even people who previously had some sort of a steady income, some sort of a job, now are wondering how they're going to continue to pay rent, how they're going to continue to feed their families, and are resorting to desperate measures. You know, in that story, like there was a young guy in his 20s. He was a teacher at a private school. He was a writer. He was an amateur photographer. He was everything the occupation wanted young people to be. But then, you know, once basically it ended. And once the Taliban took over and the sanctions started and the aid cutbacks came with them, things like private schools shut down. So this guy, you know, was unemployed. He was unemployed and he couldn't feed his family, and he had to resort to selling energy drinks on the streets and polishing people's shoes and, you know, saying that he would sell his books, you know, trying to find ways to sell his kidneys, anything to just feed his family. And he's only 20 something years old.
Which means that basically for his entire life, the U.S. had been occupying the country. And yet this is only 5 months after U.S. withdrawal. How did this all happen so swiftly?
If you look at the way that the economy was handled during that 20 years of occupation, there really was no sustained effort to create a sustainable, self-sufficient economy. You know, Afghanistan is a highly agricultural country, but if you look at the last 20 years, you know, there were so many agriculture ministers, and yet none of them actually came up with a real long-term sustainable program of how to best use Afghanistan's agricultural diversity to really be able to produce at a level where if we couldn't export out the goods, we could at the very least use it to feed as much of our population as possible. And at the same time, essentially every segment of Afghan society was reliant on foreign aid or some kind of foreign business. You know, if you were, I was in the Emirate until the middle of September, and every time I would call a hospital in Jalalabad and Herat and Kandahar and Kunduz and some of the biggest cities in the country. And, you know, even a month in, they would tell me, we're running out of needles, we're running out of anesthesia, we're running out of materials to dress people's wounds. You know, these are all very basic supplies for a hospital, but it all came from abroad. You know, it was either donations or it was imports. And, you know, you can't buy the imports if you don't have the money. And a lot of the money and the funding for those hospitals came from foreign donors and from foreign countries and from foreign aid organizations. So when all of that dried up, what happened was the hospital was affected, the school was affected, every segment of society was affected. And then, you know, these hospitals employed people, these schools employed people, and these people aren't getting paid. Either their places of work have shut down, or even if they're going back to work, they're at the very best getting paid a fraction of what they were paid, and much more likely not getting paid, still going to work, but not getting paid for it.
Okay. So here we have the UN asking actually for the single largest foreign aid contribution for a single nation in history. And yet the description you just offered me and that sort of failure over two decades to invest in local community creation of both agricultural resilience and the economy, I guess. Yes, there's a humanitarian crisis. Clearly, that must be addressed first. But I'm also wondering how you're thinking about a long-term, more sustainable investment in the economy of Afghanistan so that it is not subjected to the whims of international aid in this way.
Right. And that's the issue, is that there really didn't seem to be any sort of an effort. You know, for 20 years, the whole world was in Afghanistan, and they were pouring literally billions of dollars a year into the country. And yet, within essentially a day, everything came crumbling down, you know, because I could give you examples of my own neighborhood. You know, around me were little bodegas and there were travel agencies. They were all reliant on the offices in the area, right? For offices would buy their monthly groceries from the little bodega, right? Or they would buy plane tickets for their staff from the travel agency. But a lot of those, again, either they had foreign grants or they were part of foreign programs or they were serving NGO staff, things all of which was put to an end by August 16th. And then again, so what happens to those businesses? Eventually they shut down, and the families that they support are also now wondering how to make money. And at the same time, the average consumer, because again, they're probably not working or, and earning any money, are much less likely to be able to afford to keep buying, you know, food, to go out and buy new clothes, or to go, you know, hang out somewhere, you know. And these are people who were, who had, as I said, fairly steady incomes, fairly reliable incomes. Now, you know, the poorest of the poor have always been poor in Afghanistan, including during the last 20 years. But now even the people who had managed to rise up are essentially, now they're wondering, what are they going to do when their money runs out? And for a lot of them, it either already has run out, or it's very close to running out at this point.
Ali Latifi is a freelance reporter who's written for Business Insider on precisely this topic. Please take the time to go to thetakeaway.org and read his piece. Thanks so much for joining us, Ali.
Thank you.
This is Ira Flatto, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. COVID-19 infections due to the Omicron variant are slowing nationwide, but some states are still seeing high rates of hospitalizations, like Arizona. There, hospitalizations are up 26% over the past 2 weeks, with a daily average of more than 3,400 people hospitalized. The Omicron wave has overwhelmed hospitals and overtaxed healthcare workers who are in their second year of pandemic response.
My name is Frank Lebecchio. I'm an emergency physician and public health doctor at University of Arizona and Arizona State University.
Dr. Lavecchio told us about his experience working in the ER in Phoenix, Arizona.
Right now, we're seeing volumes and people admitted to the hospital very similar to what we saw during the peaks last winter.
And what does that mean on a day-to-day basis? I mean, it's not like emergency departments are ever sort of calm, peaceful, restful spaces. But when you're in this surge, and certainly it's been 2 years, but it's also been cyclical across those 2 years. What changes on a day-to-day basis for you and for other team members?
Right now, I think morale is the worst it's ever been. I think morale picked up once people started to get vaccinated. And we saw that we, as healthcare providers, were more likely than not going to die from this. But now we see more and more people come in that are unvaccinated. We also see more people leave the field. We've had a major exodus. And maybe you leave the emergency department and you might go to another spot in the hospital, which has led to extreme staffing shortages. It's not uncommon for me to walk in any day. And if we typically have 12 nurses to work the emergency department shift, we might have just six. Okay, that's a common occurrence. Before the pandemic, that would almost never happen. We might be too short, and that would be, you know, send off alarm bells of the severity of the situation. Now, many times we run at half staffing. Patients wait sometimes one day or so to get into a bed upstairs if they're admitted. We also see these people that leave the field, they many times would leave it for non-patient care fields. I mean, we can't compete, for example, with psychiatry, with a nurse that could do intake for psychiatry many times from Zoom. And she would get paid more because, as you know, there's a shortage of psychiatrists and a shortage of mental health providers. We also see this great rotation of nurses. I would work at the same place. I've been working at the same place for over 30 years. I know everyone by their first name, usually something about them. except for now. The last year or so, every day is something new where there's new nurses. They come from other states. We see nurses from California working in Arizona, Arizona nurses working in California. And nobody stays put. And why is that? Well, the attraction is money. If you're willing to work with COVID patients in the emergency department, I can guarantee you a signing bonus, free travel, free food, and whatever you make in 1 month, I'll give you that salary in 1 week. So even, you know, the most dedicated nurses have been leaving our place, you know, and we see others come in. People can't stay put because, you know, we're attracting these traveling nurses. And it's very, very hard for me, say, as a nurse with 30 years experience, to work side by side with somebody who is a relatively new graduate, who's making sometimes double what I'm making, and also getting to stay in a hotel room and get free meals. The same happens with clinicians like doctors and mid-level providers or physician assistants and nurse practitioners, but not as to a major degree as what's happening with nurses. A lot of our shortages are driven by nursing shortage.
Okay. Now, one other layer I want you to talk with me about, because I think that is such a helpful insight around what's happening with nurses. Give me one more layer of understanding staffing and staffing shortages and morale in hospitals right now, because I do think we tend to think of the professional roles like doctors, nurses, maybe physicians, assistants. It's my understanding that there is also a shortage in emergency departments and in hospitals in general of all of those other support workers, from custodial staff to the folks we might think of as non-professional workers, but who make all of the professional work possible. Is that something that you're seeing in Arizona?
A doctor like myself will see a patient with COVID. I might go in, order a chest x-ray. I might order some lab work. I might order some other things to be done. And what we're seeing then is the radiology tech, the person that takes the x-ray. We usually have three or four. Now we're down to two. The person that does your electrocardiogram, we usually have three or four to help with that. Now we're down to one. And almost every single one of those people that I like to say has closer contact with the patient. I mean, I have contact with the patient as a physician, but it's much briefer. These guys are in there. They're cleaning the patient, bathing the patient, you know, putting IVs in them. They have very, very close contact. And almost every single one of them has gotten sick at some time during this pandemic. And we always have somebody out. Also, somebody with that sort of degree can work at another hospital for more money. It might be a hospital down the road. It's unfortunate, but there's a big competition, you know, keeping folks like that. People who we don't necessarily think about. I mean, there's an emergency room doctor who's working on shift. He probably has about 12 to 15 support staff, whether that be, you know, nurses, mid-level providers, you know, techs, radiology techs. It takes a village. You know, the doctor is just a very, very small part of it.
Talk to me a bit about the patients. Who are you seeing right now coming in? Are the demographics of the folks you are treating now similar to earlier in the pandemic, or has it changed?
The demographics now are patients who are younger. And what I mean by that is it was almost rare to find somebody admitted to the intensive care unit who was over 50 years old, you know, when the pandemic first started. Then vaccines hit, and now it's the opposite. It's very, very common to have people under age 50 who are in the intensive care unit or admitted to the hospital. We do local data and local surveillance. And right now, when you look at patients who are admitted to the intensive care unit, the numbers for Arizona are the ratio is about 17 or 18 to 1. So for every one patient I admit who has been vaccinated, I have about 17 or 18 who are unvaccinated. So we see a lot of people who are unvaccinated. I agree, the vaccines do not protect 100%. But the main outcome measure, or the main thing we looked at when we gave vaccines to people, is to prevent you from being hospitalized.
And for the last question, what is it you want people to know? What do you want our listeners to know and understand about the experiences of hospital workers right now during this part of the pandemic?
You know, once COVID made the jump from animals to humans, okay, and we realized that we can pass it from human to human, it's 100% never going to go away. COVID will be in our lives forever. As human beings, COVID will be with us forever. The key is to control it, have it at a low level, a predictable level, and just maybe have endemic outbreaks. Okay. More likely than not, everyone's going to have to get vaccinated every year. Okay. And the more people get vaccinated, the more we can stop these variants from happening. Omicron is not the last variant that we're going to see. Okay. We got lucky with Omicron because more likely than not, it was less severe. But what if Omicron was more severe? Okay. If it was more severe, we'd see a lot more deaths right now. So COVID is here with us. COVID is here with us forever. More likely than not, everyone's going to have to get vaccinated once a year, if not more in the beginning.
Dr. Frank Lovecchio, who is apparently just framed my afternoon because I will be going out to get every cloth mask that I can find. Thank you for joining us here on The Takeaway.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Give us a call at 877-869-8253 or record your message at 877-869-8253. Or you can also send a voice memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. And we're going to go next to another humanitarian crisis that is ongoing, but all too often overlooked. Since 2011, Syria has been engaged in a devastating civil war. More than 300,000 people have been killed during the conflict, and the war has forced more than 6 million people to flee the country. These Syrians in forced exile have had to endure overcrowded refugee camps, treacherous journeys by sea, and painful family separations. Academy Award-winning director Megan Mylan is known for her films Lost Boys of Sudan and Smile Pinky. Her latest documentary follows several families of Syrian refugees, and it's entitled Simple as Water.
One of our advisors, who's a Syrian writer, sent me, it's actually part of the title of a collection of Syrian poetry, the full title of which is Simple as Water, Clear as a Bullet. And what the piece Simple as Water felt like is that it had this elemental, essential, powerful, forward force, and then a layer of sort of something that is so fundamental to our existence, but that we possibly take somewhat for granted until we don't have it.
I spoke with Megan to find out more about how she created such a compassionate depiction of people whose stories are frequently sensationalized when they're told at all.
My entry point for the film was I was the mother of a three-year-old as I got into this story and was watching the news of the Syrian exodus and specifically the migration from Turkey to Greece back in 2015, really unable to reconcile how we were allowing families who had managed to escape a war zone to need to negotiate with smugglers and climb barbed wire. And it was as a mother that I was being pulled into the story. So when I say the story, it's sort of that parental experience. But as I shifted from just reacting as a human being to trying to think as a filmmaker what was there to say about it, the experience of this, of war and of displacement is so multi-layered and such a continuum that I struggled to figure out how any one character or one family story. And so what I landed on was telling multiple family stories in vignetted kind of chapter structure. So we follow four families across five different countries. And it's really sort of a deep dive moment in time. And so the hope was that collectively, they give you somewhat of a sense, something that honors the scale of this experience.
I'm wondering if you could follow for our listeners just at least maybe one part of one family story, just so folks will get a sense of what it is they'll learn in the context of this film or experience in the context of this film.
Sure. We start the film off with a mother named Yasmin, and she's in a squatter settlement in the port of Athens. Her husband, you learn, has gone ahead and is in Germany. And his intention was that he would make sure the passage was safe and then would bring his family and children, his wife and children along with him, but they got caught up in the bureaucracy and in the smuggling boats having to navigate getting from Turkey to Greece, tried 7 different times to get across, and are now just squatting in this big industrial port. What I experienced, because everyone kind of has their own experience of the film, but what drew me and our crew into focusing in on Yasmin and her family was this sense of them being caught in this large limbo bureaucracy, Kafkaesque bureaucracy that just, you know, it was, they're so close. Any of us could have hopped on an airplane of your listeners, you know, could have just bought a ticket, and within an hour that family would have been reunited. And instead it's years of them waiting any day, thinking they might get to move forward to Germany where the father is. But for me in particular, what our field producers who first met Yasmin when we were looking to identify families, what they noted in her was just this absolute determination, despite all of the grievous loss that they had endured and the fact that they were living in this incredibly chaotic situation, that she was very, very focused on her children's forward looking. And so there were a lot of the routines of daily life that were uninterrupted. I mean, they were different. So like, she's bathing her children in between 18-wheeler trucks in an industrial port, but there's still bath time. The youngest children get their bath first. The big kids get to stay up later. Their tent was immaculate. There was nap time. There was quiet time. So all of these structures of normal home life, this sacred space of family and this home life, she preserved. And then the other really fundamental thing is she was determined for them to have joy. And so there's just a lot of laughter and play, and they go swimming, you know, even though they had had a boat that capsized and it would have made me so fearful, but we follow her out and she's not only encouraging them to frolic in the waves, but go further, be brave. And that was, you know, a chance, what I know from, you know, having spent time with not just with Syrians, but other refugees, is this intense forward focus and determination to thrive. I mean, our world tests people's resiliency so much more than I wish it did. But again and again, the refugees that you get to know, and I think you feel that through the families in the film, are so forward focused and, you know, have endured so much, but determined not to be defined or defeated by it. And so every family that we selected sort of had layers to that. So we wanted to sort of honor, you know, they've all lost something vital, something essential, but they're all not defined by that. They're going forward. They are rebuilding.
So we have the intimacy of the storytelling, but I'm wondering how does it, you nonetheless manage to tell this larger story about our international incapacity to manage refugee crises and the issues of family separation?
Yeah, I'm glad that came through for you. I mean, I think what we were, you know, and this is a constellation of people who came together to make this film. And I think our common purpose in it was to connect with people and to have them come away emotionally informed at their core. And I think the issues of displacement are so fundamental when you see families torn apart or children spending years outside of school or families unnecessarily having to make repeated risks. Those are so basic, such basic injustices that it necessitates we can do better. And so I do think that the reactions now as we've been releasing the film, that people understand we need to approach this with moral urgency. And happily, like from talking to people who are policy experts and things, there are changes that can happen that prioritize keeping families together or expediting their reunification, so children don't spend most of their childhood in bureaucratic limbo waiting to be reunited with a parent, most often with a father, you know, who's maybe gone ahead or something, or children who are in countries of temporary asylum waiting to be granted asylum in a second country out of school for years at a time during those critical years of their childhood, or, you know, offering safe passage to people fleeing conflict. I mean, displacement is our current reality, and unless we end conflict and climate change, it's our future. And so I think the question we have is, how are we going to respond to this? And there are things that can make that family experience of displacement significantly better, and so that we don't lose whole generations and additional lives.
Megan Milan is director of Simple as Water. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Melissa.